from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Unemployment rates fell in January and GDP levels rose last quarter. Both these figures may indicate that America's recovery from the Great Recession is picking up pace. But Stanford economist John Taylor says America's position is still weaker than past eras of economic growth. And he argues that America's need to return to key founding principles such as limited government and the rule of law is what's needed. He'll join us in forums next hour. That's coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Stanford economist John B. Taylor joins us in studio for this forum hour, former Treasury Undersecretary for President George W. Bush. He also served on the Council of Economic Advisors for the first President Bush and a senior economist at the Council of Economic Advisors with the Ford administration. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke described his influence on monetary theory and monetary policy as profound, and in 1993 he established what has come to be known as the Taylor Rule, an algorithm for setting short-term interest rates, and he has established himself as a non-interventionist and free market economist. His most recent book is First Principles, Five Keys to Restoring America's Prosperity. John Taylor joins us in studio for this forum hour. Welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Good to have you here. We usually talk by phone, at least in recent years, but good to see you in the flesh. Well, we're 2 years into a recovery now, and you've said in name only, low yields, and yet President Obama even this morning said we're continuing to move up in this recovery.
Well, it's a disappointing recovery compared to past recoveries. I just compare the recovery in the early 80s from that deep recession, growth was averaged about 6% then, and it's just about 2.5% now over the same span of time. And the fraction of the labor force that has jobs is lower now than at the bottom of the recession. So it's good to emphasize things that are good, as he's doing. But the reality is it's a very disappointing recovery by historical experience, and unemployment is still high, and long-term unemployment is distressingly high.
Well, you have what some have called a kind of neo-libertarian approach to the free market and all of that. And I wonder, since the free market has particularly come under such attack, people feeling that it failed during the Bush administration and so forth, and there's a great deal of skepticism about it, why are you so assured that it works?
Well, I think we have a lot of evidence, and that's one of the things I try to do in this book is look at the periods where economic growth was strongest, where unemployment came down, and that's where we adhered to these principles of, I call it economic freedom, and it's markets, but it's also predictable policy. And when we got off, and I say that's what's happened recently, we got off and we had those bailouts, we had the very easy money of the Fed for there in 2003, 4, and 5, and some of these interventions now. So it seems to me we are demonstrating the deviations from these principles are what causes the problem.
Intervention is one of those kind of ugly words for you, isn't it?
Well, not every intervention is a problem, of course. Some can do quite well. But what I worry about the interventions is when they're unpredictable and people don't know what's going to happen. And so that's a very bad kind of public policy. You want to have some reliability. You know what government will do. You know what the rules of the game are, and you don't violate them. And that's very important. I think
it's a kind of bifurcated approach that we're talking about often. You being allied with Milton Friedman and maybe even to some extent Ayn Rand, and then the Obama administration and others being allied more with Keynesian economics and Samuelson.
That's true. This distinction goes back a long time. And in the 60s, the Keynesian economics came to Washington with Paul Samuelson and his colleagues. At the same time, Milton Friedman wrote this book, Capitalism and Freedom, and that debate has continued, and that's the kind of debate we're having right now. But I think if you look at the history of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and now, you see when we move to these, I would say, more predictable rule of law, relying on markets, watching the role of government, things seem to work better, and I think that's what the data show, and that's what I hope people will come away from this discussion.
It's like dueling economists, though. I mean, we've had this featured on the program from time to time. You have people like Paul Krugman and Robert Reich who said stimulus was good, but it wasn't good enough. We needed more of a stimulus to have more jobs created.
Well, I agree. The stimulus didn't work. I think the reason is that it wasn't big enough. It was unpredictable. The money was sent to the states. The states pocketed the money. The infrastructure projects were not boosted as a result of that. The so-called shovel-ready projects weren't ready. Looked at this quite carefully. The money that was sent to individuals was largely saved and not spent. So if you look in the details of where that money went and how it was used, it is disappointing. I don't actually think making it twice as big or three times as big would have made a difference. The same kind of things would happen, and the debt would have been higher, and that's a problem.
When you talk about a sound monetary policy, though, and economic freedom and these kinds of things, from many perspectives, it's like going back, retrograde. It somehow can't be done given the circumstances economically that we're in now. And you say what to that?
Well, the world is different. And so when you apply these principles like sound money or sound fiscal policy, you have to recognize the world is different. And you have these large financial institutions and they're a problem themselves, the too big to fail. I think the too big to fail and the bailouts are really an example where these interventions make things worse. And it seems unfair, the bailing out Wall Street and not Main Street. This is a serious problem. So I think in this modern world here, you have to find a way to contain the size of those institutions to prevent them from taking on these risks. And quite frankly, finding a way for them to fail when they screw up in a way that doesn't hurt the overall economy.
Governor Romney's in Michigan this morning saying the bailout was wrong. I guess that may be a linchpin for him to work his way against Rick Santorum's popularity. Are any of those GOP candidates talking a good deal of sense from John Taylor's perspective, economics?
Well, I think they're all...
With your principles?
Yeah, I think there remains to be seen, of course, because there's lots of things to be specified. But I'd say in general, compared to the track we're on now, for example, they say we shouldn't have so many bailouts. That's a common theme. They say we should roll back some of these unnecessary regulations. That's a common theme. So I think that's basically what we should be doing. Doesn't mean, of course, government steps out of the way. It means government does what it does best and doesn't do what the market does best.
You've been... in many ways critical of the Fed, zero interest rates, I think you feel, are contributing to a slow recovery?
I think all the interventions they've done led to the crisis. They had these rates very low, 2003, 4, and 5. That stimulated the housing boom and excess risk-taking. And then they tried a little efforts to increase the liquidity, that we call it, the money supply, and that didn't do any good. So now people just don't know what they're going to do. And I think if they went back to the kind of, I would call it rules-based policy, predictable policy, and they knew what they were up to, as we had in the 80s and 90s until relatively recently, things would work better. And this is really not a partisan issue. It seems to me we've seen good performance with Republicans, good performance with Democrats, and bad performance with Republicans and bad performance with Democrats. It's really understanding what the performance is and what the policy is. And I think that's what I'm trying to stress so much. It's not really a partisan issue.
Well, in fact, you point out, as many do, that under Richard Nixon, we had wage and price controls.
Right. I mean, he came in as a free market guy, and look what he did. He said, we don't need markets. We got to impose these controls.
But if it's nonpartisan, well, I'm looking actually at Paul Krugman article where he says, of course, George W. Bush, whom Taylor worked for, did shift the course of American government to produce markedly bigger spending and bigger deficits in the long run, and I've never found anyone to claim that Taylor uttered a peep of complaint about these policies while in the Bush administration.
Well,
from Paul. That's actually from Brad DeLong.
Okay. Well, there's lots of questions about what people do when they're in government. My job was on the international side, and we had the financial crisis in Argentina to deal with. We had an enormous amount of financial problems with setting up the terrorist financing networks, with the Iraq issues and the Afghanistan issues, fundraising. But I think the truth is there was a thing that I had most problems with early on in the Bush administration was this temporary tax rebate. It was a Keynesian policy in 2001 where money was sent to people, and I don't think it did much good. That's the kind of thing that was done in the 70s. We kind of avoided in much of the 80s and 90s, and we got back to it. And of course, there was another Keynesian stimulus package in 2008 with President Bush, and then the just gigantic one with President Obama. So you can see the sense in which this is not a partisan issue.
How do the tax cuts, though, which Republicans have been behind solidly and firmly, really help create jobs? I mean, they're talking about cutting taxes as job creators, and I don't see, for example, people in hedge funds necessarily hiring more people to work for them because they get tax cuts.
There's absolutely, you're correct. It doesn't always make a difference, but on average it does, because it's just common. This is sort of basic economics. What I teach my students at Stanford: if you tax something at a lower rate, you're going to get more of it. Tax something at a higher rate, you're going to get less of it. That's basic, just what you, basic economics. The question is how strong those effects are. And what I would say in addition to this, and what is, I think, different about the interventionist approach versus the, I would call it, steady-as-you-go approach, is you get taxes to the right level, and then you don't increase and decrease. You don't have these temporary things, temporary payroll tax cuts, temporary tax rebates. They just don't do much good. And just get the tax system where it should be and leave it there for the most part.
As I read your book, I come to the realization that what you want most of all is stability in markets. I mean, you feel that Ronald Reagan particularly typified
Well, he came in at a time where things were incredibly turbulent, you know, double-digit unemployment, double-digit inflation, double-digit interest rates, so very low growth, productivity growth, and did make a big change. But it lasted. It lasted through President Bush 41, and for that matter, through President Clinton. And President Clinton, of course, the famous State of the Union address, where the days of big government are over and welfare reform. I think those are examples of what I think are good, and they worked well. We had good economic growth in that period.
Except there's always the concern, and this is what Democrats bring up in the partisan battles, of the safety net being frayed and torn as a result of those kinds of economic policies.
There is a huge disagreement about that, but as I see the way the welfare system behaved after that, it's better. You have fewer people on the rolls. There is more other alternatives, such as this earned income tax credit, which is a more efficient way to do that. So I think, in fact, if you have that same approach to deal with Medicaid and Medicare, it could work much better.
Talking to Stanford professor John Taylor, his new book is called First Principles, Five Keys to Restoring America's Prosperity. Here's Jonathan Chait in The New Republic, March 1, 2011. John Taylor is the man Republicans use to back up their unconventional fiscal program. It's worth keeping in mind that Taylor's basic role is to support Republican fiscal policy in any and all circumstances. He supported it when he worked for George H.W. Bush and proposed deficit-reducing policies. He supported it when the party abandoned those policies. He supported it when it was making highly unpersuasive attacks on the Clinton budget program. He supported it during George W. Bush's presidency, and he continues to support it when Republicans have since decided that Bush was a failed big spender.
Well, comments like that is what you get when you're in the public arena and talking about what's right and what's wrong. I think if he read my book, for example, you'd see there was even-handed discussion of what Democrats did and what Republicans did. There's quite a bit of things here about what the Fed did in the period 2003, 4, and 5. So I think the main thing here is to forget the messenger for a minute and look at what is being said. And that's what I hope people do. Obviously, I worked for Republicans, and as you mentioned at the beginning, I'm an admirer of Milton Friedman. But I think what people should do is, if they can't, especially in these days where partisanship becomes really an impediment to getting things done, look at what's said, look at the data, look at the discussion, try to compare the viewpoints, understand why economists disagree. But I think if you're just going to look at the messenger and criticize the messenger, that's not the way to go. That's not the way to improve things.
Well, you have had a profound effect, like Ben Bernanke said, the quote I gave earlier, on economic policy. And, in fact, I think you may be somewhat at odds with Bernanke now. You certainly have been with Greenspan, or were with him, because of abandoning maybe what you want, or you see them as abandoning more what you want. But I want to get to the Taylor Rule. I mean, you even have a rule named after you, 1993 Taylor Rule. And I think it would be useful and illuminating for listeners to understand what the Taylor Rule is. Can you put it in lay terms for us?
Sure. It's actually pretty simple. The Federal Reserve, of course, sets the short-term interest rate, and that's what they decide on at their meetings. And this rule describes a good way for them to go about it. And so when the economy goes into a slump, they cut the interest rate by a certain amount. That's the recommendation. The economy speeds up, they raise the rate by a certain amount. And most important, if inflation picks up, they raise it by a certain amount. And what, to my surprise, after I proposed this is when central banks, not just the Fed, but the central banks were pretty close to this kind of a rule, if you like, or description, things worked pretty well. Things did work well in this dimension in the 80s and 90s until relatively recently. And emerging market countries, which have been doing relatively well compared to their past and even compared to us, they have been following these kinds of rules and it's worked well. So much to my pleasant surprise, this has been a pretty good formula.
Well, there's also another Taylor formula I got from reading your book, Predictability and Rule of Law Equals Prosperity. But then I find myself thinking or reflecting about Greece. If the economic growth isn't there, if the sectors aren't producing, then prosperity can't follow.
Well, Greece is such a perfect example of what I'm talking about. There are these indices of economic freedom, the point you just mentioned. Greece is 119th in the world economy. It's next to last after Bosnia in Europe. It is worse than many sub-Saharan African countries in these measures of what good economic policies would be. So in a way, it's not surprising they're having all these problems.
But you've said we can run up debt and find ourselves very much in the same kind of situation.
Absolutely. And that's why I think it's so important for people to realize we've got to reduce the growth of the debt. I have some really distressing charts in my book of these as exploding debt, and that's future generations are going to have to worry about that. We should worry about them. I bring my grandchildren to my economics one class at Stanford so the students can say, hey, these are the people you got to be worrying about, and they look at the charts and it kind of helps.
But what do you do about economic growth? I mean, here in the United States, let's focus on that. I mean, it's certainly a problem in Greece and all this austerity is being imposed, but they don't know where they're going to go as far as economic growth or what kind of sectors they can actually provide catalysts for. In the United States, we become more and more a service economy. We've got a global economy. How do we essentially provide? You talk about incentives, you know, and incentives are very important. But all this outsourcing that's going on, where do the incentives come from and where's the growth come from?
Well, in the United States, I'd say we need to get to the point where there's more incentives to create jobs here. There's more incentives to expand business firms. That's where the jobs come from. It's a business investment. There's where the taxes come into play. But I think right now it's really this predictability of policy. And this is a dispute amongst economists why we are having this slow recovery, why things are not getting better faster. And I think it's the unpredictability of policy, the concerns about the debt, the concerns about inflation perhaps, or deflation even. And that's a difficult business environment. It's a lot of anecdotes about that's what's going on, and I think you can see it in the data.
I had mentioned Paul Krugman before, and what I read was from Brad DeLong, but here's Paul Krugman via Brad DeLong, who says, I see that John Taylor is peddling the zombie claim. This is in the New York Times, April 25th, 2011. Is peddling the zombie claim that there has been a huge expansion in the federal government under Obama. A large part of it is slowdown in GDP rather than an accelerated rise in government spending. What we're seeing isn't some drastic expansion of big government. We're seeing the government we already had responding to a terrible economic slump. Taylor, who is a very good economist, has to know this. He shouldn't be spreading disinformation. That's Paul Krugman.
I think Paul is wrong here. Data just tell you, say in 2007, federal spending was about 19.5% of our GDP. It went up to 24-23% of GDP and projected to stay there. That seems to me like a permanent increase, first a binge of government spending and then an increase. If it were projected to come down to 19.5%, then he would be right. But no one's projecting that right now. I think that's the right thing to do. But the data don't support what he said.
The data can be using different forms of measurements, though, right?
Well, you can do things with data, unfortunately. Statistics can lie if you...
You say liars figures lie.
Yeah. But I think the challenge here is to put it in simple terms. Sometimes you need a chart. Sometimes you need the kind of data I just talked to you. There's really no disputing those numbers about 19.5 and 23, 24. Those are Congressional Budget Office, the Office of Management and Budget, other analysts. Some of them are projections, but that's what's there.
Again, you'd like to go back, though. I mean, in the sense of spending, for example, you want to go back to 2007. We heard President Obama's State of the Union speech. He's not going back to 2007 spending.
No, he wants to increase spending. That's a different philosophy. There's no question about it. But remember, when President Clinton left office, federal spending as a share of GDP was 18.2%. It was higher after President Bush, 19.7%. And now it's 24. So my feeling is that people, let's recognize that. It's when you, and I say go back, by the way, I don't mean go back to different type of world. I mean follow these principles that we've seen, like economic freedom principles, which we've seen have worked so well, again, with different administrations.
John B. Taylor's book is First Principles, Five Keys to Restoring America's Prosperity. And we should mention that, well, we've been talking about them, but you want to run down the five keys for us?
Sure. Basically, you want to have a situation where individuals can decide what to buy and what to sell, who to hire, where to work, how to help other people, but in a context where there's, number one, a predictable policy. Number two, the rule of law is what the basis of these decisions are made on. Number three, you're basically relying on markets. Number four, the incentives to do the right thing that comes from those markets. And number five—
Free markets, essentially. Yeah.
Well, yes. Well, by definition, a market is one where there's prices are determined in the market. And if you want to intervene in the market, you should have a good reason to do that. But I would say number five is a well-defined role of government based on cost-benefit analysis. Government should do what it's best at doing and let the market do the other part. So those are the principles. And you can see how when we got close to them, things worked well. When we got away from them, things did not work. So
I want to qualify free markets because this is a non-intervention principle too, really, isn't it?
You know, there's different ways to intervene. Look, for example, economists talk about externalities, the environment, and it's important to recognize that you do have these externalities. There is a role for government in providing controls, if you like, controls on the financial sector. We're guaranteeing deposits, so the government has a role there to reduce those risks. The government has a role to play in reducing the pollution, if you like. So what I would say what you want to do is when you can, you use the markets to do those things. But there's no question there's a very important role for government in the economy, and I would be the first one to try to find the best way for government to do the things like that it should be doing.
Well, you've been critical of the bailout, like Governor Romney. What could have been done instead of the bailout, which was an intervention?
Well, I'm critical of all the bailouts,
Let's talk about the banking bailouts.
The banking bailouts are the ones that are most concerned because there was really very little rule of law there. You have a bankruptcy code that is well understood, and that was just ignored. We went and bailed out the creditors of Bear Stearns, and then we decided not to bail out the creditors of Lehman, a big surprise to people. Then we went and bailed out the creditors of AIG. Then we turned it off and had this so-called TARP, which was rolled out in a very chaotic way and I think scared the market. So I'm very critical of all that, and I think it's very important for us to get back to a place where these bailouts don't occur.
I know you're an economist, but how about rule of law with prosecuting some of those who are very guilty of fraud?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also enforcing the regulations. There's some rules out there about what banks and other financial institutions would be doing. Why didn't we enforce those rules?
John Taylor with us in studio this hour. You can be with us as well. In fact, we welcome your phone calls. He's senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, professor of economics at Stanford, and served as Undersecretary of Treasury for International Affairs from 2001 to 2005. We welcome your involvement in the program. Feel free to join us now. Toll-free number available to you is 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us on our website. Post your questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment, and you can also join us on our Facebook page. We do welcome your involvement. Again, John B. Taylor here with us in studio. His book, which is now out and available. I've got the copy that went to press, and now he gave me a real copy. It's called First Principles, Five Keys to Restoring America's Prosperity. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with John Taylor. Unemployment rates fell in January and GDP levels rose last quarter. Both these figures may indicate that America's recovery from the Great Recession is picking up pace, but Stanford economist John Taylor says America's position is still weaker than past eras of economic growth, and he argues that America needs to return to key founding principles such as limited government and the rule of law. It's all outlined in his new book, which is called First Principles, Five Keys to Restoring America's Prosperity. He is senior fellow at the Hoover Hoover Institution and professor of economics at Stanford, and also served as Undersecretary Treasury for International Affairs under President Bush, 2001 to 2005. That is President George W. Bush, and served in the Bush the First administration and in the Ford administration. Let me go to your phone calls, and we'll begin with Lemoyne. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. It seems like there's really a factual dispute that surrounds a lot of this discussion. It seems like there's data out there that indicates that in the 50s and 60s, the U.S. economy grew at a higher clip than it has in recent years. And that was a period where the economy was much more regulated, it was a much more bigger private public sector, and where there was a much higher union density. Moreover, if you look at countries like South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, those countries all developed a manufacturing base that was developed by the state protecting and nurturing those sectors. And it was only after they were established that those economies then opened up those sectors to competition. So there's really, it seems to me, by focusing on the last 20 years, we're really missing a lot of data out there and a lot of trends out there. And my fear is that, you know, all of this amounts to essentially a dismantling of the public sphere. And we're kind of heading towards a sort of a gated community capitalism where, you know, if you're in, you live behind a gated community, you go to a private school, you know, you have your access to your health insurance, you know, your little gated community builds its own roads and...
All right, let me interrupt you, Lemoyne, because I want to get a response to what you're outlining here. Yeah, thank you for the call. John Taylor.
Well, those are very good points. I'd say the reason I focused on the last 50 years, it's really most relevant to our current circumstance, but even if you go back to the 50s and early 60s, things were doing well. I think the big interventionist move began in the, I'd say, the mid-60s and lasted through the 70s, and that was respect to monetary policy, interventionist fiscal policy. We had wage and price controls of all things in that period, wage and price guidelines. So I think the evidence is clear, even if you go back further. The other countries you mentioned, I think the real evidence here is, for example, when China moved towards more free markets. They haven't moved all the way, but they moved tremendously compared to where they were. It's been an incredible boom. You compare North Korea and South Korea, there's just no comparison. So that's the data I look at. I agree it's difficult to sort through it all, but I think it's pretty clear. And with respect to your concerns at the end about opportunity, I think the problems with not having enough opportunity are these special favors people get because of government having a big role. And I would like to see more opportunity, better education, where people don't get into these situations where they can't advance. We would like to have those opportunities.
You also talk a lot about 1982 and the recovery from that recession.
I do, because it was a very deep recession. Unemployment got higher than in this recession. It was a real tough time for high unemployment and also high inflation. And really there was this dramatic shift from policies of the 70s, which included Nixon and Ford and Carter, to policies which were much more steady, much less interventions with Reagan, continued with Bush 41, and for the most part President Clinton. So I think that's really a place where you not only can see that it makes a difference, but you can sort of see why? What did people do? So I can talk here about what we should do, but the more important thing is how do you do that? Which people do you elect, and how do you make sure they can deliver what's so important? So I think studying this history is important, not just to establish what works and what doesn't, but also to establish how do you actually get things done that really will make a difference.
We'll go to more calls. Casey, you're on. Join us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on, and I had a comment that I'll make first, and I wonder why Paul Krugman is even valid anymore. He was saying that the economy was great and swell, and there was nothing wrong with it right before the crash, and the same with Ben Bernanke. But my question for your guest is why he would make a rule for the interest rate instead of allowing savings rate to set interest rates the true free market way.
Well, that's an excellent question. In fact, what the Federal Reserve should do to get that interest rate is to adjust the money supply and the amount of credit in the economy, and the interest rate is then determined in the market. But the Federal Reserve's responsibility is really basically to control the amount of money supply, the amount of money in the economy. That's its traditional role. And by doing it, it affects the interest rate. And my formula basically is just a way to guide them really ultimately in setting money in a way that gets the right interest rate.
Let me thank the caller and go to a web comment here. Does Mr. Taylor favor the sort of limited government rule of law which allowed 11-year-olds to lose their limbs sorting coal, private employers to call out troops to shoot down strikers, and manufacturers to spoil or lessen our commonwealth by polluting it? That was what we had the last time things were as many at the Hoover would have had them. Many seem to not understand Mr. Twain's point in calling it a Gilded Age rather than a Golden.
Well, I think it's a, you know, that's a view that many people hold. I don't think it's correct description, of, certainly of my view or other people who want government to play the role that's appropriate and not more. Those are examples where the rule of law is violated dramatically, where you have people shooting, law enforcement people shooting other people. I mean, that's not a characterization of good.
It's not really laissez-faire economics.
No.
Here's James who says, so if we tax something at a higher rate, we get less of it. I think we should tax extreme concentrations of wealth at a much higher rate, since such is clearly bad for the economy.
Well, wealth creation is, I think, good for the economy, quite frankly. We'd like to have everyone have more wealth. Concentrations is a concern. How do you deal with concentration? I think you have competition. You basically don't allow government-supported monopoly, or you allow our antitrust laws to work efficiently. Concentration.
You think concentration wealth trickles down? Is that the kind of the Margaret Thatcher theorem of trickle down?
I don't think concentration trickles down. I think wealth. Everyone would be better off if everyone was wealthy. Everyone was better off.
All boats are lifted, type of thing.
Well, either they're going up on their own because of their opportunities to advance and the incentives to do that, or they're working for a firm and they get hired, or they advance at the firm. I don't think it's trickle down. It's both trickle down, trickle up. It's a dynamic economy where if you have the right opportunities and the right freedom to advance, everyone can do so. And to be sure, this is something where there are impediments. I think education is probably one of the biggest impediments that we have. People are not getting young people are not getting the training, especially in the poor areas, inner city areas, and they're really going to be doomed if we don't fix this.
What do you think about Newt Gingrich saying they should work as custodians, students particularly?
Don't know that details what he's talking about there, but it certainly makes sense to me to give people, young kids, the opportunity to experience work and deliver newspapers. I mean, we all have done that sometime in our lives, and I think that's part of opportunity.
Another listener, Dan, says, sounds like Professor Taylor should be a supporter of Ron Paul. Is he?
Well, you know, Ron Paul has some good things to say, some crazy things to say. It's what I think it's best to not identify the things I'm talking about in this book with any individual, including me, quite frankly, but to read what they are and to see how they work. And then actually, I think, yes, elect the people who you think are going to most likely deliver on these things, not that just they espouse them, but they're actually going to be able to make a difference regardless of political party. That's what I argued. To take these principles, they work, get the people who can implement them, and we'll be better off.
But you see them more coming from the GOP candidates than you do from the Obama administration.
I say right now I do. I do, absolutely. But again, if you look at the history, look at Richard Nixon. He looked like he would be doing these things beforehand, and look what happened. So it's more complicated than simply what people say.
And whoever knew, apropos of the last hour, that he would go to China. Well, here's Red from Oakland who says, it was rampant mortgage, at best sloppy and at worst unethical and perhaps illegal, that got us into this mess. Is that not intervention in the economy? I'm not excited about regulation, but sometimes it's necessary. It seems, in this case, regulations on lending with real consequences could have prevented this mess. No?
I think by and large, the regulations were not enforced. And I think the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, these government-sponsored enterprises, are a good example. The government could have limited the amount of risks they took, and they decided not to. They were pressured. It's a good example of so-called crony capitalism. So I'd say in this case, you do have rules on the banks, rules on the mortgages, and those should have been enforced. But I think there's a great dispute, of course, of what caused the financial crisis. My view is a big part of it was those very low interest rates that the Fed decided to go ahead with in 2003, 2004, and 2005, and that encouraged the housing boom, encouraged
That was an incentive to buy housing.
Yeah, absolutely.
John B. Taylor, our guest, his book, First Principles, Five Keys to Restoring America's Prosperity. And Colin, join us. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Professor Taylor, I wanted to be clear with you. Is it your opinion that AIG and Citigroup should have been liquidated rather than bailed out after the failure of Lehman Brothers in 2008? Was that the position of George W. Bush and the Republicans in Congress who had voted for TARP?
Well, clearly it wasn't because they voted for it. But what I would say is that go back to the Bear Stearns bailout. At that point, let's give people the benefit of the doubt. It came on as a surprise. But at that point, a clear description of what the strategy was going to be if Lehman had problems. What was the strategy going to be for this clear credit issue in the banks that you're referring to? That was largely ignored and kicked down the road. So that by the time Lehman failed, it was a huge surprise, and then we did bail out AIG. I think all those things could have been prevented by a more predictable policy. In fact, I think we still need to change the law so that these kinds of things don't happen.
Another listener on our website, James, writes, didn't we try mass regulation from 2000 to 2008? I remember 2008. It was really, really bad. Why are we even talking about returning to 2007? Deregulation, excuse me. You're not talking about returning except in terms of cost spending, though, really.
Yeah, no, I think it's the spending is a share of GDP is what I was referring to at that point. And I think we don't want to go back to this period where we didn't enforce the rules and regulations. We let financial institutions take on too much risk. Their banks are the most heavily regulated institutions in America. Why were they allowed to take on that risk? And that's what we got to prevent in the future.
Bobby, you're on with us. Welcome.
Hi there. I was just wondering, it seems that if you allow suppliers and employers to just kind of do their own thing, it'll eventually become the only way you can compete is to kind of practice to, do abusive practices. So, a man falls in the meat vat, you sell the meat anyway. How do you keep this from happening yet still be non-interventionalist? I'll take my answer off here.
Yeah.
Thank you for the question.
It's a good question. There's a question of balance. I think the way to approach all these things with a cost benefit, and when you have regulations, they should be rationalized and justified, and we do need them. There's no question about it. But they can go too far, and you just don't rely on the markets anymore. And I think that's what I'm concerned about, where we're going now. And the deregulations that occurred in the late 70s and early 80s, airlines, energy, I think those basically were very beneficial. We, of course, regulated the safety of the airlines. We just didn't regulate the price and the entry. And that's been beneficial. There's lots of evidence for that. So this is not an either-or thing. We either regulate or don't. We have to regulate where it's appropriate. And then I think, again, most important is once we decide what to regulate, we have the rules, we enforce them. We don't just give favors to people who give big contributions.
Going back, though, John, to intervention, job creation was at least tied to the stimulus, and you've already stated that you were opposed to the stimulus and led us down the wrong path from your perspective. What about intervention for job protection as a general rule?
Maybe you could describe what you mean by job protection.
Well, I mean, we've got all these jobs that are being outsourced, and we need to protect jobs and can sometimes through intervention, through government intervention, and sometimes even with a heavier hand necessary.
Well, I think what you find is the jobs, people creating the jobs are business firms for the most part, startups, big firms. And so you're going to create jobs by giving them the incentive to create the jobs. And so when you say prevent, prevent people from
losing
being
jobs.
Laid off?
Well,
So look what happens if you prevent someone from being fired. Then people are going to be reluctant to hire someone because you say, oh, boy, if I hire this person, I'm not going to be able to let them go. That's really one of the things that's happened in Europe. You have very strong restrictions on dismissing someone, and so then firms are reluctant to hire. This is one of those unfortunate things where the incentives gets – you think you're helping. It's like an example of this. This is a unintended consequence of think you're going to make better by saying you can't let someone go, but the unfortunate consequence is you get fewer hires as a result.
Again, our guest is Professor John Taylor. His book is First Principles, and our next caller is joining us, and that is you, Matt from Livermore. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Professor Taylor, you mentioned that the government spending increased over the last 15 years from like 18% of GDP to 24%. I was just wondering how much of that increase is due to an increase in spending on interest on our debt, how much is due to an increase in war spending in Iraq, and how much is actually an increase in government programs?
By far, most of it is an increase in non-interest spending. Of course, our debt is higher now, but the interest rate is so low, that's not a big part of the reason, because you got to have the interest rate times the amount of the debt. So it's largely programs. Of course, the military is part of that. If you compare from 1980, I'd say maybe 1.5% of that. That should be drawn down over time. But it's largely spending.
We thank you for the call, and we go next to Janet. Janet, you're on.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to ask what the guest thinks about how they do things in Denmark, where people are pretty heavily taxed, but they have everything. I mean, they have education, they have medical, they have everything. I'm just curious about that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you for the call. They also have the highest happiness index in Denmark. It may be a lie to the fact that they're covered womb to tomb for the most part.
Yeah. I'm not an expert in Denmark by any means. I think when we have a good economy and things are prosperous and everybody's benefiting as much as we can, things work well. But the measures of happiness are hard to come by. And I at this point I'm thinking about let's just get people employed, let's get higher wages, let's give people opportunities.
And by the way, if you'd like to join us in the time remaining with Professor Taylor, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page. We'll go to more of your calls, and we'll go to Tony and Pinol. Good morning. Tony, you're on. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to ask the professor where he was in regards to the repeal of Glass-Steagall, and also where his position was in terms of regulating the new derivatives market, which totaled over $60 trillion, which many economists claim is the reason why we had the major collapse.
I think Glass-Steagall, it's hard for me to see, is that the reason for the problem? After all, you think about Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, they were just regular old investment banks and would have been with or without Glass-Steagall. And so there were a lot of problems began right there. So I don't think that's the thing I would point to. With respect to regulation of derivatives, again, if you look really carefully at what happened, AIG, I think, is the prime example, and that had to do with derivatives. But again, there was a failure of regulation, not so much that we didn't have the regulations on the books at the time, but that AIG was regulated by an organization that was best described as something that organized thrift institutions. So that was like an example of poor regulation of existing rules. But I must say there are some changes in the derivative law now where they have to be traded on organized exchanges and some more transparency, and I think that's an improvement.
And we thank you for the call, Tony. Let me go to some more of your emails and web comments. Here's a listener who says, shouldn't there be a sixth principle about limiting money in politics? Isn't that the reason the rule of law wasn't followed with the bailouts and enforcement of financial regulations stemming from corporate influence in government?
Well, it's a very good point. I would attack that by really limiting the role of government, quite frankly, because the more government intervenes, the more ability it has to give special treatment and special favors. So it's another reason to be very careful about overexpanding government. And again, I would also say that keep these rules and regulations simple so that these crony ideas or the benefits of special interests are obvious to people. And that goes with respect to the transparency about contributions as well. So transparency can go a long way here, I think, from preventing these abuses.
John from Oakland writes, Michael and John, thanks for the great discussion. Thank you, John from Oakland. How do we achieve predictable policy in the context of our political system that changes administration every 4 or 8 years?
That's an excellent question. Well, you have to have people who recognize the importance of it. And there's, I think we did have 80s and 90s until relatively recently across a number of different administrations and controls of Congress because people recognized the benefits. They were so informed, if you like, from the problems of the 70s that they didn't want to do this. And then people tend to forget. They say, oh, well, let's intervene here. Just one little thing. Let's intervene there. Let's change this policy. But actually, just an example.
Actually, excuse me for a moment, but you make a point that I think is a very telling point in your book about how there is when you get into campaigns, there's a desire to say, I'm doing something, absolutely, as opposed to just allowing things to flow predictably. And that, you use Reagan as an example of that. People would quarrel, perhaps, with you. But I think it's an interesting point that those who are running for the presidency feel they have to offer interventionist policies because they have to move things forward and say, I'm going to be doing something.
It's the hardest thing in government. I worked in government. Everybody wants you to do something, and the politicians want to do something. And it is the hardest thing. But I think that's one of the reasons I'm trying to get these ideas out in this book. But when people came into government and said, we're intervening too much, and we're going to have a steady-as-you-go policy, and there are lots of cases in history where people tried to do that, it's why you want really courageous public servants and get them in there that'll stick to the principles.
Some clarity sought by some of our listeners on a few points. Here's a web comment from Levin Berkeley. He says, it seems to me that your guests sidestepped a question. When asked whether the Bush administration tax cuts for the wealthy have produced jobs or overall economic growth, Mr. Taylor responded that a basic law of economics tells us that when you tax things less and thus reduce their cost, you will have more of them being produced. Unfortunately, those tax cuts were not levied on firms who create jobs, but on the personal monies of the wealthy. These are not commensurate.
Well, I did refer to the basic principles then. I think the evidence here is always going to be, just to be candid, hard to prove. We had, I think, a strong couple of decades in the 80s and 90s from reducing taxes. It wasn't pure, or sometimes they increased. And I think for the most part, we had a difficult time in the 2000s with 9/11. You had the corporate scandals early on. You had a huge amount of uncertainty. So my sense is that it's not a good idea to raise taxes. I mean, put it that way. In fact, so right now, I'm not saying we should cut taxes. I'm just saying we shouldn't increase them because, we have a weak economy. Why would people want to increase taxes? And I think that's what I'd like to stress. I think there is a lot of evidence out there. People can quarrel with it. But I think we have the theories, we have evidence, and why would people want to increase taxes now to make the economy stronger? It just doesn't seem correct to me.
But do you think legislators should essentially sign an oath in blood that, I mean, isn't, I've said this before on the air, that the basic civics teaches you that democratic government is done by compromise and negotiation, and they're simply stalwart about not budging one inch when it comes to taxes.
I don't think
thanks to Gordon Norquist.
I don't think you had to do those signing pledges. I think you get in there and you do what's right. You're representing the population, representing your constituents, and you do what's right. But in terms of giving, if you like, on taxes, I look at the numbers, and to be quite candid, we have a huge spending problem. I mean, I wish I could convey that on the air without a chart. It's just this explosion of spending. And increasing taxes, yeah, it'll help, but just a teeny bit. And so I would say let's focus on the
You could bring
problem.
Down entitlements and increase taxes, couldn't you, or make some kind of balance between the two? That's what I mean by compromise.
Yeah, if you want to compromise that way, but I just don't think that's helpful. I'm so concerned about this debt. I'm so concerned about our fiscal situation that if we just get into debate and say we're not going to do this unless there's a tax increase, then I think we're really going in the wrong direction. And
next time you come in, bring your grandchildren with you.
In terms of my grandchildren. But in terms of my grandchildren is what I'm thinking about.
Here's another listener who says, this is Mark. Your guest today seemed to dodge the question, quoting Paul Krugman. Krugman's point was that government spending as a percentage of GDP went up in recent years because the GDP has gone down. Point being that government hasn't grown much at all. The guest ignored that last part and just repeated the stat. Could you ask him to follow up?
There's two things that I think you're referring to about Paul Krugman. One is he argued that spending was going to come back down again. But the second point, which you're making now, is that GDP did fall. And, of course, it did fall. But if you correct these percentages and assume GDP didn't fall, the story is quite similar. There has been an increase in spending, not just relative to current GDP, but relative to what GDP would be if we didn't have a recession.
We go to more calls. Edward, join us. You're on. Good morning.
You want to reduce spending to 2007 levels, but Ron Paul wants to do 1 year better by returning to 2006 levels and cut $1 trillion in his very first year. But my question is that some people say Ron Paul is crazy to want to return to a gold standard, but he doesn't actually want that. He wants a competing currency so people can decide if they want to trade in dollars or something else like gold, silver, or even Facebook credits. Could you explain how competing currencies would change things?
I think, quite frankly, the simplest thing is to have a single currency and you have a central bank, but the central bank adheres to clear rules and don't do so much intervention. There are some theories that would work with competing currencies. Those are interesting. I teach my students that. But I think just in terms of keeping things simple and basic, this is a role for government, and I'm comfortable with that, but it has to be constrained like so many other things government does.
Let's try to get another caller on here. That's you, Russell. Join us.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I noticed you asked the question, I believe, earlier that what would have happened if they would have just let the big banks fail. And so my question is, what would have really happened if they would have just said, sorry, you're bankrupt?
I think in the case of Lehman, for example, if they had made it clear in advance that that was a possibility, and when they got close to it, it became clear, they could have made the adjustments. The damage was caused by this sudden decision on a Sunday night that you're going to have to go into bankruptcy, and that was a shock. There's no question about it. But again, predictable policy. We're going to play the rules by the rules here. People could have adjusted, and I think it would have been much smoother than, in fact, what happened.
John B. Taylor is senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, professor of economics at Stanford. He served as Undersecretary of the Treasury for International Affairs 2001 to 2005. His book, First Principles, Five Keys to Restoring America's Prosperity. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you, and we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated in the evening. You can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling 415-553-3300. And you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to kqed.org/forum and click on this segment. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell, and our interns, Kyle Palmer, Ernesto Morales, Keith Mansoni, Catalina Villegas, Dana Varinsky. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.